Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Folks, I want to thank you for just leaning in during the last segment around sexual assault and around healing. Please note, you're still free to call about that. Justina's standing by. She not only has a number for you for Jada McCray, but she'll also give you the sexual assault hotline. We definitely want people to move towards a path of healing. It is about your own journey and about finding a place to be at peace. You cannot change the past, but you can begin to unpack the trauma. And I'm a firm believer in that. Folks, we're going to switch gears now, and I'm excited about where we're going to go because I have in the studio with me Dr. Barbara Ramsey. She's the author of the acclaimed biography, Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement, that came out in 2003. She's one of the founders of African-American Women in Defense of Ourselves in 1991. We're going to talk about what that means. In the Black Radical Congress in 1998. She is the editor of the journal Souls, a critical journal of Black politics, culture, and society, a professor and director of the Social Justice Initiative at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and she is the author of the new book, Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. Dr. Barbara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm delighted to have you. She's also, I'd be remiss to not add, she's the past immediate president of the National Women's Studies Association. We've talked about this on the show before, and so we're going to spend some time this hour, and we invite you to join us in this conversation, talking about the state of the Black Lives Matter movement, talking about ways that we can bend our privilege. We're going to look into her new book, Making All Black Lives Matter. We're going to talk about ways how we can work to change the political and the economic and the social landscape of this country. How do we push back against the policies coming out of the White House, and how do we do the hard work to get this country to finally accept the fact that our lives matter and we should not have to continue fighting this battle long after I'm gone and my sons have to pick this work up. We'll do all of this in this hour, and we want to invite you. Give us a call, 410-319-8888. Let's talk about ways that we change, I would say starting with the city, Dr. Barbara, and then we can move to the world. Can you talk to us first about your new book, Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century? And what I thought was interesting when I started pulling all of the writings about this book, that people said that they see this as a love letter to the organizers of the movement for Black Lives, that this is a way of giving some names and voices to all of the people who did the work. And this is something that's kind of a chord in your work, right? You made sure Ella Baker's name was known and put her first and foremost, but you did this in this book as well. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, you know, I'm a historian, so usually I write about dead people. So these people are very much alive and in motion. So that was a challenge, you know, to keep up with them, to keep up with the movement as I was writing about it, writing about kind of history in motion. But I think you're right. I think I did view this, in a sense, as a collective biography, not of a single, you know, individual, but of a group of people who've been at the forefront and at the center of this movement. And some of the names we don't know that well. Some of the names we do know well. We know the names of, you know, Alicia Garza and Patrice Concolors and Opal Tometi as the founders of the hashtag Black Lives Matter. But I talk about other people who've been some of the behind-the-scenes organizers, people like Charlene Carruthers, who has her own book out now, was leader of Black Youth Project 100, people like Tenjiwe McHarris, who works with a group that came out of Ferguson called Blackbird, Alicia Saunier, who was a young person who was just on the streets in Ferguson, became politicized in the moment of the Ferguson uprising. So I try to hold up those people and talk about them as real human beings, women in particular, you know, who are in the process of trying to make social change and respond to the situation of police brutality and racism in our society. So, I mean, I think one of the things about the book that I argue pretty strongly is that Black feminist politics, the Black feminist politics of intersectionality, have been kind of the ideological foundation of this movement. And that's never been true before in the history of the Black freedom movement. So young women, young men and women, but young women in particular, many of them queer, very unapologetic about that, you know, have been launching these organizations, have been leading protests in the street, have been holding retreats and meetings and writing position papers, and kind of holding down this movement in a very interesting and profound way, but also putting a set of politics around gender in the mix in a way we have not seen before. So that was one of the most interesting things about it. I mean, there's other aspects to it, too, that I think are important in this moment. I mean, the other thing, of course, is that, this movement erupts under the tenure of the first black president.
Right.
Which is significant. And I think it represented an understanding that simply getting black people in high places, brown faces in high places, is not going to save us. Many of the young people in the movement voted for Barack Obama, campaigned for him, but were disappointed that he did not or could not deliver and realize that building a movement, building organizations in their communities was really what was going to push back against police violence, economic violence, and all the other aspects of things that compromise our lives.
Now, it's a little difficult to begin to critique Barack Obama in this way. There are some people who are ride or die fans for him. Like, you cannot say that he didn't do anything right. Just showing up, apparently, was enough for us. But I'd like you to talk just a bit about, just drill down for a moment, about that point that this movement actually erupted under Barack Obama, but the feelings of this movement have been going on, I would say, maybe as far back as Emmett Till, really.
Oh, yeah, and even further. I mean, the problem with historians writing something is there's always a prologue to the prologue, right? So there's a chapter before the first chapter and before that chapter. There's history is a series of continuities and ruptures. Right. But there are continuities always. So black resistance to vigilante violence, to state violence, goes back to the slave patrols, and violence on, for enslaved people before emancipation. But certainly in the South, we think of the lynching of Emmett Till as being a pivotal turning point in 1955. Many of the urban uprisings of the 1960s and 70s, when I was growing up, Detroit, Watts, Harlem, were about issues of police brutality. So in some ways, it's a continuation of that, Ferguson and Baltimore and the various protests in between. But it's continuations in other ways, too. One of the things I try to talk about is, like, what kind of organizing traditions have mm-hmm. they tapped? I spent a lot of time, as you know, writing and researching the life of Ella Baker.
Right.
And one of the hopeful things about this movement for me as an Ella Baker scholar is the ways in which she shows up in Black Lives Matter, of decentralized leadership, rejecting the idea of a single charismatic leader, relying on grassroots folks, bringing marginalized folks to the center. All that really echoes of a black political tradition that Ella Baker and others were very much a part of. So I see both those continuities and those ruptures in this movement.
Now, it's interesting, even though decentralized leadership is, I think, a central part of the Black Lives Matter movement, there was always this sense from the media that there needed to be a leader, whether it was a DeRay McKesson, for example, right? So showing up and running in front, kind of in the same vein as Dr. King, but that people on the ground, the activists that you're talking about, pushed back hard against that narrative.
Yeah, push back very hard. No, I think, I think we have very narrow notions of leadership. I mean, in popular culture, we want a King, we want a Malcolm, we want a Marcus Garvey. Often they're male leaders, or an Angela Davis. But we want someone who is symbolic, who in some ways knows things we don't know or can do things we can't do. And I really think it's a critical test of this movement and future movements, the degree to which we can get past that. Mm-hmm. Yes, there have been heroic people in our history who have done amazing things, who have been extraordinary, but it's been the ordinary people that made their greatness possible. And Dr. King, of all people, knew that lesson and spoke about it quite eloquently on a number of occasions. In this movement, I think there has been some celebrity making,
right.
Maybe intentional and self-promoting, right. And some of it unintentional. But what I see on the ground, the people who are doing the hard work of building consensus, building organization, developing strategy, that is not glamorous work. It's not work you do in front of a TV camera. It's not work that you brand the way you, right. brand an article of clothing. So that's the work that really sustains us in the long term. So there's all these kind of contradictions in movement, but the predominant force that has propelled this movement forward has been this decentralized notion of leadership and organizing.
Now, I want to talk about the Black Lives Matter movement, because there's a sense that people have that since you don't have the actual protests in the street happening, I mean, I remember that time, as I know you do as well, when it was almost on a daily basis. There was another video being released, another movement in response to that. I mean, it got to the point where it felt like that nothing but black death was being centered in our lives, right? There was like a snuff film type quality to watching unarmed black people die with such regularity that you were no longer shocked by that. Yeah. So since that wave has seems to have passed, because now we're so focused on 45, like he takes our attention in a way that nothing else did before Black Lives Matter, has Black Lives Matter been dismantled? What's happening with the movement now?
Well, I think it definitely has entered a new phase post-November 2016. But let me say a little bit about pre-November 2016 to set the stage for post-November 2016.
That's the historian in you.
It is. But I think there'll be some missing pieces if I don't say that. I mean, I think a lot of people think of Black Lives Matter as a single thing, right? Like, as a single entity. But hashtag Black Lives Matter emerged after the acquittal of George Zimmerman for Trayvon Martin's murder, as you know. But out of that came something that we now call the Movement for Black Lives, which is both a coalition, but it's also a larger rubric. And under that rubric is a whole constellation of organizations that are doing very different kinds of things. I mentioned Black Youth Project 100. Mm-hmm. In Chicago, we have Asada's Daughters. In Florida, there's the Dream Defenders. New York, there's Million Hoodies. There's a myriad of organizations in that larger ecosystem. And so they've been doing different kinds of work. And I think when we think of, you know, the trajectory of the Black Freedom Movement, it's very rare when we see a large explosion of protests, but that doesn't mean people aren't doing anything.
Right.
Before the Montgomery bus boycott, before the March on Washington, there were all kind of periods in between where there's political education, there's strategy making, there's base building in communities. And so I think that's some of the work that's going on now. Some of the energy, you know, to get to the point of your question of post election of 45, you know, there have been some efforts at electoral politics. I mean, some people did work on Stacey Abrams' campaign and Gillum's campaign in Florida, local campaigns in different places. There's been a lot of discussion about what does it mean to do transformative work in the context of electoral politics, which are often so limiting. And so I think that's a very productive and generative conversation that's happening. Many of these organizations do have local campaigns that are going on. I know there's a campaign around housing for people who have formerly incarcerated in New York and elsewhere. So there are local campaigns, and then there's like downtime strategizing that's going on in many places. The Movement for Black Lives is planning a gathering next year and has also given rise to a new coalition called The Majority, which is a Black-led, people of color-led, multiracial coalition of 50-some organizations that's planning a gathering, a convening in 2020. So there's all this stuff underway. It's not that people have gone to sleep, but I think there's been some regrouping. You know, people were woke, and I don't want the notion to be out there that people are now asleep. But I think, you know, we were hit hard by the election of 45, and I think there's some regrouping going on.
Now, what's interesting, to turn the conversation to Baltimore, and I know that, you know, you live in Chicago, but you also have a long lens on the historical ramifications of what happens with redlining, what happened with Jim Crow, what happens in cities that have been underdeveloped for a number of years, right? When you start talking about the intersectionality between being, you know, impoverished and being black and having an educational system that's less than stellar, that when we begin to look in Baltimore City, trying to figure out a way to move forward, thinking about a way to strategize on the ground, what are some things that you would suggest? How should people begin to push this city forward? And I'm talking about people on the ground, not you know, those who have these all these coalitions, but we're talking about just the mom who's upset, or or the dad who can't figure out how to get things moving in his own community.
Well, I know there's a lot of organizers in Baltimore. I would not be so presumptuous as to come here and tell them, you know, how to organize Baltimore. But what I can say is this, from my experience in Chicago, and I lived in New York, I organized in Detroit, you know, over the years, that we do have to get beyond individual solutions to mm-hmm. systemic problems, right? So, yes, it's the mom and the dad, and we're trying to navigate our lives and raise our kids and, you know, keep our heads above water, but we need each other in order to make the kind of changes that will affect individual lives, and that requires collectives. And I guess I'll say self-critically, you know, one of the things I think the movement is weak at this point is creating entry points for ordinary people to get involved, you know, other than voting. Other than voting, what do you do? And I would say, you know, we need to start organizations at the very, very local level. We need block clubs where people are talking on a daily basis about what kind of city they want to see. Mm-hmm. In Chicago, we do have a coalition of many different organizations called Resist, Reimagine, Rebuild Chicago. There is also a mayor's race, which will be historic. We have, I think, 4 or 5 black women running who are going to be on the ballot in Chicago, and several of them quite progressive. So, so it's the point at which we talk to each other, we see how we can form consensus with each other, we see how we can stay in community with each other. Those are the ways I think we begin to change a city. And voting is a part of that, but it's not the only part.
Now, I will say, just to follow up on what you said, we love the folks who are organizing here in Baltimore City. We support them. They come on our show,
I'm
from
sure.
Losing a Beautiful Struggle on down. But I do think it's something to be said for having kind of what they call the long arm of history.
Uh-huh.
As someone, as you stated earlier, that you grew up in the 60s or 70s, you've seen at least some of the impact of the civil rights movement. And then as a historian, taking an even longer lens, to then look and say there are some things that you can do, even from the outside,
mm-hmm.
suggestions that I can see with drilling down. People were very disappointed in this last election.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of coalition work around, you know, Stacey Abrams, around what was going on in Florida, and people got to the polls, and then they got to the polls, and then the results were not quite what people expect. But I want to have you, because it's something that you put out on Twitter, the idea that just because you didn't see an immediate change in mm-hmm. leadership doesn't mean that change didn't take place.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. And I mean, one of the benefits of being a historian, and I guess one of the benefits of getting old, is you see change over time, you know, when you didn't expect it. And I always say, I spoke to a group of students at University of Maryland last night, and one young woman said to me, she looked all of 19, and she said, you know, but things don't change fast enough. And she said, I'm impatient. And I said, well, you know, things are going to change. We're guaranteed that.
Right.
And you can play a role in it. What you do or what you don't do will impact the future. But we know for sure things are going to change. It's just a question of what shape that change is going to take. So, yeah, you know, this the outcome of this election was not ideal, particularly some of the high profile campaigns like Stacey's and Gillum's. But in Florida, for example, about 1 million people who are formerly incarcerated with felonies are going to be able to actually be, you know, voting citizens. That's a big deal. So I think sometimes we put our eyes on a particular prize and we miss the smaller victories that come our way. I also think, you know, Stacey has not stopped fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So she's fighting against the voter suppression that robbed her of the election in Georgia. I think that is a continued campaign. I think that's precisely the kind of measured victories. If you have a bunch of people in motion after an election to make some kind of progressive change, that's a victory, whether your person gets in there or not.
So in this world of the Donald Trump presidency, which is
strange world we're in,
which I think it's all connected, right? So then I'm thinking about this long arm of history with mm-hmm. this trope I keep coming back to,
mm-hmm.
but that you had the election of Barack Obama,
mm-hmm.
you had this feeling by a portion of the white community that something had been lost with
mm-hmm.
the election of Barack Obama. You had the organizing that took place, and then the white lash is what they call it, right? So here comes Donald Trump on the heels of Barack Obama, the heels of Black Lives Matter, and there's a feeling that we're losing ground under this president. Can
mm-hmm.
can you speak about that and maybe ways that we can begin to push back?
Yeah. Well, I think the pushback is going on, and I think it is right to assess we're losing ground. I mean, one of the things I said to some young people who were reluctant to vote in this past election because they didn't like Hillary, you know, and I was not a great Hillary fan either, but I did, in the final analysis, vote not so much for her, but against Donald Trump.
Right.
And I think what's happening now is we're fighting a lot of defensive battles. You know, the consent decrees that were won, this Justice Department is rolling that back. The voter suppression that's going on, some headway had been made in that regard. Having Betsy DeVos at the head of Department of Education is a big blow. So we're fighting battles that we thought we had already won. Mm-hmm. And that is a step backward. But I'll say, you know, in terms of struggle, there's always an ebb and flow. I have seen more people reach out to call meetings, to start petitions, to contemplate new candidates, to draft things that they're going to put on the ballot. So I do think it has both inflicted a defeat, but it's also incited a kind of determination in many of us that would not necessarily have been there otherwise.
Now, one of the things I want to talk to you, and I know we're going to take a break in a second, but I just want to put on the table, coming out of Black Lives Matter, the movement that I felt was ongoing, mm-hmm, I mean, it hasn't stopped. I'm very clear about that. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about the exposure to the videos of unarmed Black people dying, that I've had teachers and parents reach out to me like, you know, how do I help my children, Black children, come to some type of reconciliation around this? How do I help them to feel comfortable and safe when the next video could be a person that looks just like them or on their block or in this? Like, how do we deal with that part of it?
Yeah. No, I definitely think it's been a trauma-infused movement. And the social media has both helped us to mobilize around these murders, because a lot of people don't believe this kind of, you know, shooting somebody in cold blood in the back, which is what happened with Walter Scott in South Carolina, or, you know, shooting a child, unarmed child in a park like Tamir Rice, would not have believed that it went down that way had they not seen it, right? So the power of those images galvanized people and won people that wouldn't have been won otherwise. On the other hand, many of the young activists saw these things over and over and over. And I think, you know, in the movement, there is a certain amount of trauma. I'm happy that many of the leaders and organizers have taken that seriously. There's a health and healing council in many of the organizations. There's, you know, all kinds of ways in which people are seeking to decompress, check in with each other. It's a very humanistic strand to this movement that, quite frankly, my generation wasn't so good at. We were like, it's struggle, just toughen up. You know? But I think they are taking seriously the kind of trauma that comes with the violence that they're resisting.
And not sure exactly how to talk through that, right? We're trying to, or so it seems like we're trying to even develop a language around healing from being exposed to these incidents. I know when Tamir Rice, when he was shot and killed, it was the same age as my son. My son's name is Amir. And there was something for him saying when his friends shared the video at lunch or on the playground that there was a running joke. Oh, Amir, this could have been you. You add a T and you're Tamir.
Yeah.
And him having to wrestle with that. When we come back, I want to talk about the work to get younger activists involved, kind of in the same spirit of Dr. King, where you put 7 and 8-year-olds. How do we get younger groups to be engaged for the long haul? Mm-hmm. I want to talk about this ongoing feeling that Black people's lives are in danger. I'm talking about the constant calling of the cops. Mm-hmm. And then where do you see the movement for Black lives going as you write about it in your book and kind of going forward? Mm-hmm. Folks, this is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. I'm talking to Dr. Barbara Ramsey. She is a writer, historian, professor, and an activist. She is based at the University of Illinois at Chicago and the author of Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. She will be at Red Emma's tonight at 7 p.m., but you can talk to her here, 410-319-8888. Let's take a break and we'll talk on the other side. Today with Dr. K, I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Folks, I'm here with Dr. Barbara Ramsey, writer, historian, professor, and activist. She's the author of the new book, Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. She'll be at Red Emma's tonight at 7 p.m. in a conversation about her book. And I am just delighted to have her in the studio with me, talking about where do we go as Black people who are concerned about social justice, who are concerned about, you know, living and keeping ourselves moving forward, and also concerned about healing and dealing with trauma that's infused in our children with being exposed to this ongoing struggle to convince the world, unfortunately, that our lives matter. Dr. Barbara, thank you for staying with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what's interesting is as we think about this kind of cycle around justice and freedom, this notion of having to convince the world that our lives matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a historian, if you could talk about the fact that, you know, I think black folks have been here before trying to convince really white America that first of all, that they're human and that they do hurt, they do heal, but that their lives are just as valuable mm-hmm. as their white colleagues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, some people have criticized Black Lives Matter for saying it's an appeal to white people to validate black humanity. I think it's both an appeal and a demand and an insistence. It's an affirmation of black humanity, right? That we understand the dehumanizing nature of state violence in many different forms, and that, you know, Black Lives Matter was essentially saying we will not tolerate it and we will disrupt business as usual in protest to this reality, right? We will name it. I think it also got us beyond a kind of fuzzy notion of people of color and talked, you know, once again about explicitly anti-black violence, which mm-hmm. is so prevalent and prominent, again, going back to the institution of slavery. But let me say this also. I don't think we talk about black people in an undifferentiated way sometimes. You know, the kind of state violence that this movement has risen up against has really been a protest against the targeting of poor and working class mm-hmm. black folks in particular. Because it's not mostly college professors and lawyers and doctors who are being shot down by the cops. I mean, you think of Eric Garner in Staten Island, who was strangled to death by the police. You think of Walter Scott, who was shot down. You think of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, who was selling CDs out of the back of his car. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, Eric Garner was selling loose cigarettes to support his family. So these are people in the underground economy, in the informal economy, people who are vulnerable by virtue of being black, but also by virtue of not being middle class, of being poor and or working class, being marginal to the economic project of this country. So, an economic project this country has marginalized them. So those folks are especially vulnerable, and I have been very, really energized and proud of this movement of taking up the notion that, you know, all black lives have to matter, that it's not just middle class folks that can, you know, prove that they're respectable Negroes, you know, in the old school terms, that will be afforded, you know, the courtesies of citizenship, that everybody's life matter. It doesn't matter that, you know, if Mike Brown had shoplifted earlier in the day
right.
Or not, that should not have been a death sentence if it happened. So I think bringing that issue of class into it is really important.
I think it was an awakening for me. I, growing up as the daughter of a civil rights activist, pastor, bishop, who led me to believe in so many ways that the fight is already over, that we struggled on your behalf, we went to jail, we lost lives, mm-hmm. so you can be comfortable. I want you to get married, move to the suburbs, put my grandchildren mm-hmm. into sports, drive them in your SUV, and you never have to worry about racism. That's already been taken care of. I think it was an awakening. Mm-hmm. It was a moment when you moved away, I guess, from Eric Garner and using Alton Sterling as examples, to thinking about Tamir Rice as just a child playing, and thinking about Jordan Davis as a young person at the 7-Eleven or kind of like a gas station with his friends, realizing that just because you have made a certain amount of money, you have a certain number of degrees, you have, quote, made it in American society, you are still not safe. Because mm-hmm. when your children go outside, they can't stop and say, no, wait a minute, my mom has a government job, so I'm fine.
Mm-hmm. That's like, true. So that's true. Yeah. Although, can I say this?
Yes.
I do think that children of middle-class folks are a little bit safer.
Mm-hmm.
Not entirely. I mean,
yes.
Because you don't have class credentials, but there are many instances where cops will pull somebody over, they will interact, they will realize that the person is someone with certain kinds of connections or credentials,
yes.
and they will back off. Not always. I think we are all vulnerable, but I think we also need to acknowledge that we have different levels of vulnerability.
I think that's a good point. I'm so glad you said that, because I was just sitting here when you pushed back and a little bit thinking, you know, my son doesn't get on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he does get driven everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
When he has said to me, if the cops pull me over, I'm going to make sure I get out my school ID because they'll know my school's name.
Yeah.
And that in his mind, all the things that we've worked to do for him are ways to protect him in that. If, of course, he has the moment
mm-hmm.
to do it. If the bullets are just flying,
mm-hmm.
there is no moment. But,
right.
you know, how do we then lean in? So for parents who don't have that class protection, if I may call it that,
mm-hmm.
then what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's why we need a movement.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I just saw the movie The Hate U Give, which, you know, deals with a young man who is, it deals with all the things we're talking about, a young woman who goes from a working class black neighborhood in Atlanta to a all white school because her parents want her to get a better education than she can get at the local school, but she's still they're still committed to their community, and one of her young friends gets killed in front of her. And so she navigates both the class divide, the racial divide, and this question that you're raising, the vulnerability. And her father instructs both of his children, what do you do when you're pulled over? Here's how you have a defensive game when the cops pull you over, to give them no excuse, right? To give them no reason whatsoever to use force. And sometimes you don't have to give them a reason.
Right.
But he was saying, here's all the precautions that you can take by making yourself look as harmless as possible in that situation. So I think, you know, many of us have those conversations with our kids, you know, navigating a world that we did not create. How do you do that as safely as possible with your dignity intact? And I think that is an important survival strategy for young black people, certainly my kids, your kids, et cetera. But as an organizer, I have to say, it's our job to work to change that reality so that they're not navigating that.
Which I push back a little bit, because I start thinking about the fact that, you know, when I go in and we do some of the training here with young people, what do you do when the cops stop you? Mm-hmm. There's always this divide that I'm feeling. One, you know, about teaching our children to get low. You know, to be as harmless as possible, to do whatever you have to do to stay alive, with juxtaposing that against this notion of how do we teach them how to thrive, not just survive being black in America, but that you have the opportunity, you have the right to be able to thrive, to be able to have some righteous anger saying, I wasn't doing anything, that we can't even speak in defense of ourselves, lest there's a fear that the cop might take it in the wrong way, and it end up with us dying. Like,
well, everything
that.
Is context is everything, right?
Right.
So I think there's a dual approach of both. I think there are situations where we do have to lay low. I mean, you're in a dangerous situation. Somebody has a gun and you don't. I mean, that's not the time that I'm going to say everything I believe. but I tell you what, I'll also do. I'll get that badge number, and I'll get that the license plate, and I will follow up when I'm in a safer space and when I have my people with me, that I can, you know, push back, try to hold them accountable, expose what's happened. But I'm not going to do it at the expense of my life in that moment. I might say there are things that I would give my life for, but I don't want to do that recklessly, right? So there are moments when you can't say everything. You know, this is life.
There's
moments you can't say everything that you should be able to say. But that doesn't mean that you lose your dignity, that you stop fighting, that you don't, in every other way that you can, stand up to racism and injustice.
Now, folks, if you're just joining us, this is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. I'm here with Dr. Barbara Ramsey. She's the author of Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. She will be at Red Emma's tonight at 7 p.m., but we thought we'd get a little sneak preview of the conversation. You wrote a piece in the New York Times that said, Black Lives Matter is democracy in action. Now, you've talked a lot about that, but we have a lot of our callers who don't believe in the notion of democracy. They said that, you know, democracy doesn't work. So can you kind of perhaps lay out for us why democracy might be, pure democracy might be one of the answers we need going forward?
Well, I talk about, you know, sort of radical democracy or deep democracy or participatory democracy to distinguish between a kind of facade of democracy. So democracy, you know, every person voting and picking this guy or that guy when it's not much of a choice doesn't feel very empowering, and it's not. And sometimes it actually masks enormous inequalities and disenfranchisement, even though you can say literally people can vote. So I'm not talking about that kind of democracy. I'm talking about, what does it mean to engage with other people, to make collective decisions together, to be radically inclusive, which is hard work. It's hard work and it's messy work. I mean, even if you're just talking about all black people, you know, if you're talking about black people in a, you know, of a similar demographic, right? Everybody has a different idea. How do you get on the same page? How do you function as a unit, as a community, and not just as individuals, you know, 50 individuals with, you know, 51 different game plans. So that's what I mean by democracy. And I think the movement's democratic in the sense that it has resisted any inclination to throw any sector of our community under the bus. It has gone through painstaking processes to include many, many different voices. Not all, but many voices. So I think the practices, the style of leadership, The insistence on including the most marginal and people who, you know, in terms of the politics of respectability, may not have been at the center of movements in the past. I think all that represents a radically democratic impulse in this movement.
Now, we know one of the things that's been happening a lot, and it seems like it's died down a bit, or I hope it has, this notion of white people who are calling the cops on black people who for simply living our lives. I mean, we know there's a whole line of things that come off Twitter, from sitting in Starbucks to walking your dog, that puts your life at risk. How do you help young people, or how would you advise young people how to navigate around this? Because now we're just talking about regular, everyday action. We're not talking about going out and protest. We're just talking about going and getting your mail. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a feeling that you're moving in the wrong space because you're moving within a body mm-hmm. that has been stigmatized as being dangerous.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there have been some good kind of on-camera examples of this. There was a young man who was using a swimming pool at a apartment complex, and the woman summoned the security guard to ask him to show his ID. And in a very firm way, he both resisted that, and there was a crowd around, so I think that was created a margin of safety. He wasn't with one cop with a gun on a dark right. road, which is a more dangerous situation. And he, you know, he stood up to that, and one of his friends videotaped it, and it was shared. And ultimately, there were apologies, and, you know, I mean, it was exposed that this was a lot of racist assumptions and stereotyping, mm-hmm. you know, built into that. So I think that's one example, right? I think there's a lot of, you know, of course, there's a lot of situations where that continues to happen. I was just in South Carolina for a wedding, and I went to pick up someone who had rented a house in a gated community. I was going 30 in a 25-mile-hour zone, right? And I was pulled over by but see, here's the other thing, not by a South Carolina cop, but by a rent-a-cop, by a security guard in this private development, kind of, you know, right. a paid version of George Zimmerman. And he was very presumptuous and rude, and you know, I stood my ground, so to speak, in what I thought was a safe way. I wasn't going to tell him everything I thought in that time, but I did, you know, file a complaint later. So I think these are examples of how, as individuals, we can navigate this. But there's one other point I didn't make before, Kay, that I really do want to put on the table, which is that many of the names that we're throwing out are names of men. Yeah. And sometimes we talk about young black men being vulnerable, which they are. I'm the mother of a black son. You're the mother of black sons. But we also have to talk about young women mm-hmm. who are vulnerable in all kinds of ways, including to sexual violence. But one of the things this movement has done in a very important and powerful way is put forward the names of female victims of state violence of all sorts, from Rukia Boyd in Chicago mm-hmm. to Corinne Gaines. Ayanna Jones, mm-hmm. Corinne Gaines here outside Baltimore, and a whole list of others. But the Say Her Name campaign, which Kim Crenshaw and BYP 100 and others got on board with, was to foreground those names, was to remind us mm-hmm. of all the ways, including sexual violence. You know, the case in Oklahoma of the cop, Daniel Holtzclaw, yes. who had sexually assaulted women in custody, some of them sex workers, some of them people who had been vulnerable for, you know, because they had a police record. And the movement rallied around them. And I thought that was really important because I could see another time when those women wouldn't have been sympathetic victims, right. wouldn't have been believed, would have been violated, and would have had to just suffer alone and in silence. But this movement said that, you know, that all Black Lives Matter, and their lives did too.
So as we look at Making All Black Lives Matter, your book, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century, if we can go forward a little bit, because you kind of give this, you know, wonderful love letter, which mm-hmm, I think that people should take a look at mm-hmm. in terms of trying to understand the history of Black Lives Matter, as the way you spelled it out, as an appeal, as a demand, as an affirmation, as a hashtag, as a movement, as a moment, as something that's ongoing. But where do you see it moving to? So we still have another year or so, maybe two, I mean, I'm dealing with 45, mm-hmm. and my hope is that he doesn't get reelected, but there's a chance that he might. Mm-hmm. So just mm-hmm. with that in place, where do you see the movement going, and how can people find ways to use it to kind of propel them forward?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the movement is looking at all kinds of formations. I think I've been very pleased as a researcher and a writer that political education is being taken very seriously. There are teach-ins and think tanks and workshops where people are drilling down learning more history, learning more theory. And I think that, you know, that may sound not like struggle, right? but I, you know, ideas are the dress rehearsal for action. So the more people have a big picture assessment of the problem, the harder they can fight, the smarter they can fight, et cetera. So I see that going on. I see institution building going on. I see people looking at alternatives, people involved in the food sovereignty movement, doing community farms and community gardens. I see people looking at restorative justice as an alternative to prisons and police. And that's, restorative justice work is not just sitting down and saying, I'm sorry, you know. It is often a very long, drawn-out process of how do you make restitution? How do you compensate for harm that has been caused? Which the current, you know, criminal justice system that is based on revenge and punishment doesn't do anything for victims. So I see the restorative justice movement as a real humane alternative to that. So not only are people saying we're against this, we're mad at the cops, you know, but they're also saying here's how we're bringing creative energies to bear to create something different. And that's very hopeful to me.
Now, I want to take you back because we just came out of dealing with, not too far back, back to 1991,
okay.
Going back as far as yesterday.
Okay.
But I bring that up because we dealt with Kavanaugh and Dr. Christine Blasey Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it mean to confront the person who sexually assaulted you in a public forum?
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about just going to the cops and, mm-hmm. and you know, telling your story or going to the newspaper, but in this huge public forum, in much the same way that Anita Hill dealt with Clarence Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, there was a number of women, I want to have you talk about the African-American women in defense of ourselves, mm-hmm. that I saw when I was in law school, and it just mm-hmm. completely blew my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could talk about that and why that's still relevant today.
Yeah. Well, there's been renewed interest in African-American women in defense of ourselves. We called it a we do. because of the Christine Blasey Ford situation, and there are obviously some differences. Of course, Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill were black, and Christine Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh were white, but also Christine Blasey Ford was alleging sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
Anita Hill was alleging sexual harassment. It was important for a number of reasons. It surfaced the issue of sexual harassment in the black community. What does it mean to, for one black person to confront and expose another in public? And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have a tradition of not airing dirty laundry. We don't want to, you know, give white people another reason to be critical of and disparage black people. And that has had a silencing effect in some regards, in terms of women not speaking about issues like sexual violence and sexual harassment within oppressed communities. Aisha Simmons did a wonderful film a number of years ago called No, which really, you know, had showcased the testimony of many African-American women who had suffered in silence, who had been persuaded to not come forward and so forth. So I think the Anita Hill moment was important in that regard. But what we did with African-American women in defense of ourselves, it was not just about her. It was about black women asserting our collective voice. Because what we heard in the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas controversy was people were saying, well, either you believe her as a woman or you support him as a black man.
Right.
Which invisibilizes that intersectional experience of African-American women who are both black and women. At the same time. And so we talked about what it meant to be a black woman like her coming forward in that context with this array of white judges really
mm-hmm.
in front of her in
right.
terms of the Senate committee. So, so I was an important mobilizing effort. We mobilized 1,604, actually, black women to contribute money over $50,000 at that time, which was a lie at that time. To put an ad in the New York Times and into many African-American newspapers. It was a statement of support for Hill, but it was also a statement about racism and sexism in the society.
Now, what's interesting, even though the situation was different, you know, you mm-hmm. laid out with Ford and Kavanaugh and Hill and Thomas, in so many ways the result was the same.
Mm-hmm.
That Thomas was, of course, seated and has been
yeah.
really just a force that has worked against
mm-hmm.
the freedom of all people
mm-hmm.
in terms of his position on the as a justice. And then, of course, Kavanaugh has
mm-hmm.
been seated and keep leaning this court towards the right. I want to talk about Me Too and kind of open that up because you mentioned about the ways in which in the black community, there's this feeling that you can't speak about what happened. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about it because we don't want white America to further ostracize our black men. We have to stand together on a platform of blackness as we suppress gender, mm-hmm. Which means we're suppressing all the things that come along with that. Mm-hmm. So with the Me Too movement, which in so many ways seems to spotlight a lot of white women, mm-hmm. I'm putting Bill Cosby to the side, but it spotlights mm-hmm. a lot of white women. How do we make the space for black women and people who gender identify as women, mm-hmm. and also for men and young men who have been sexually assaulted and harassed, to be able to speak their stories and pull back this veil of shame mm-hmm. around sharing this? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think Me Too gets labeled a certain way, like the women's marches have gotten a lot of play, and there were, are a lot of white women involved. But, there have been many campaigns around supporting and highlighting the experiences of black women and women of color. I'm thinking of Insight Women of Color Against Violence, mm-hmm. Beth Ritchie and Andrea Ritchie, and a number of people were involved in that. And that actually was one of the preludes to the movement for black lives I outline in the book. People looking at domestic violence, sexual violence, as an extension of state violence. And so I think that's important. I mean, one of the reasons that many, particularly working class black women, don't tell their stories, A, they don't feel they're going to be believed by, quote unquote, authorities. Right. But more importantly, they don't trust the police. That often the police come in and they will not look for the perpetrator, but arrest any black man in sight. So it brings more danger into a household and into a community than resolving. So I think people are looking for other methods to intervene and to keep us safe. And that's, again, that's the kind of alternatives that I was talking about before. I want to hold up Beth Ritchie's book, Arrested Justice, mm-hmm. which talks about this continuity of violence and talks about ways in which the white women-led anti-violence movement looked to the state for solutions in ways that were particularly dangerous for black communities. And she gives a number of examples of, people calling the police because they were in need, because they were victimized, and then being further victimized by the police, right? And she really critiques a movement that sees the state as a solution for violence in our communities. Now, I say I'm an aspirational abolitionist. That is, I want to build a society where we don't need police right. and prisons. We don't live in that society just yet. But I do think people are trained to rely on the police far too much, to call the police for every little thing. And oftentimes it does, in fact, make it better. And police are not actually trained to help people. They're trained to hurt and contain and control people.
Right.
That's their training. I don't know how many times I've seen police, pass people by who are in need on the side of the freeway, right, where they could, perhaps an intervention might keep that person safe from other kinds of harm, but right. that's not, but then come in guns blazing when they're called for in a situation where there's a mental health problem in a family. We had several situations like that in Chicago. Families call the police because
yes.
somebody was having a mental break, and the police end up killing them. In one case, they killed the person having the mental break and a neighbor who came out to see what was going yes. on. So anyway, so I think looking for alternatives that are humane, that we have some control over, is really the hopeful forward-looking option.
That was interesting. We just have a couple minutes left, folks. I'm talking to Dr. Barbara Ramsey. She's the author of the book, Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. She'll be talking about this in conversation tonight at Red Emma's at 7 p.m. We're getting a little bit of a sneak preview. So we have the long arm of history for the civil rights movement. And we have the long arm of history when you think about Jim Crow. We can see the successes and the failures and whether or not it worked, the strategies worked. Could you take us and just think for a second, 50 years into the future, if we were to look back at this moment in time, mm-hmm. How do you think history will judge us, or herstory?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so hard to say, really, because there's so many twists and turns in the road going forward. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not a fatalist. I'm not a determinist. I believe what we do or don't do is going to determine what that looks like. And I'm hoping that all the energy that's going into imagining a different world, demanding a different world, insisting on dignity and inclusion at this moment, critiquing, we haven't used the word capitalism, which is a word I use a lot because I think that racial capitalism is something we have to critique. is systemic. It's not accidental, you know, that certain people are treated like their lives right. don't matter. They're disposable. I mean, slaves were dehumanized, but actually their labor was valuable. Right. So they were dehumanized up to a point, but masters didn't eliminate property.
And so with that in mind, with masters not eliminating property, their labor was valuable, mm-hmm. but they were dehumanized.
They were dehumanized. They were brutalized. It was a brutal system. But the purpose of it was to extract labor.
Right.
Right. And now I think that this stage of capitalism, many people are surplus to the capitalist economy. And so, you know, their lives or their labor doesn't matter.
I like that. They're twists and turns on the road to get us to where we need to be. Folks, I have had just the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Barbara Ramsey. She's a writer, historian. She's an author and professor. We have Ms. Washington on the phone. I'm looking at Justine to see if we have time. We have Ms. Washington from Owens Mills who would like to chime in. Ms. Washington, how are you? Welcome to the show. I believe Ms. Washington is gone. Well, you know, she'll be there at 7 p.m. tonight, Dr. Ramsey, when you're at Red Emma's talking about your book, Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. Folks, I think that as we think about what we need to do next, it's making a decision about the type of world you want to live in and then being willing to put something on the line. This type of work takes a little bit of sacrifice. What are you willing to give up to get us to the next place we need to be? Dr. Barbara Ramsey, thank you so much for just joining me.
Thank you for all the work that you do, Kay.
We appreciate you as well. Folks, this has been Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. The show is a production of WEAA. Produced by my award-winning producer, Justina Paula. We had Dre Melton on the board. Tonight, 7 p.m., join Dr. Barbara Ramsey, writer, historian, professor, and activist at Red Emma's, Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. And then make an appointment tomorrow at 3 p.m. Give me a call. Let's talk about what you learned sitting under the tutelage of Dr. Ramsey. Here's a quick update from MTA, and we'll talk some more on the other side of tomorrow.